This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The federal government reopens, at least for a few more weeks. President Trump and some members of Congress accuse the FBI of bias and hint there is evidence of a secret society within the agency. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is questioned by the Special Counsel's Office as the investigation into Russia's interference in the presidential election continues. And President Trump is scheduled to make his first State of the Union address next Tuesday. Joining us to discuss these and other top political stories are political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ken, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, guys. Howard and Mark, how are you?
Good, thank you. And good. Howard, good to see you too.
Good to see you, as always.
Yeah, before we launch into our discussion, and there is a lot to discuss today, what is the trivia question?
Well, you know, like it or not, this year's Super Bowl is between the New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles. And if truth be told, I will confess to the world that I dislike both teams. But the trivia question is, look, well, you know, what can I say? But both teams are from the East. You know, can I just interrupt for a second? I'm a New York Giants fan.
Oh, no.
And a few weeks ago, I was reading my newspaper, but it was upside down. The Giants were in first place. And I didn't realize my paper was upside down. I didn't realize. Anyway, okay.
You digress.
Both teams. Yeah, exactly. These acid flashbacks. So both Patriots and the Eagles are from the East Coast. The question is, when was the last presidential election that featured two major party nominees who were born on the East Coast?
Okay. So you want the year and you want the combination. Is that right? The two candidates?
That's good. The year and the candidates, right.
Okay. If you think you know the answer to that, call 513-419-7100. The first caller with the right answer will win a political junkie button. 513-419-7100. So Ken, with this government shutdown, I blinked and I pretty much missed it. I mean, I always enjoy your historical perspectives. Was this one of the shortest shutdowns we've ever seen?
Well, actually, most shutdowns in the past have been of 2 or 3 days. They don't get the kind of attention that they got in 2013, for example, when it was shut down for 16 days. That was the Ted Cruz shutdown. And then there was also a Gingrich shutdown in 1995, 1996 over a balanced budget that Bill Clinton wound up outsmarting the Republicans. But, this is a usual one, but it's interesting. We spent so much time, newspapers spent so much ink on talking about this thing, and yes, it was gone. And when all is said and done, the question is, what changed? What happened? What resulted from it? And I dare to say not much.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, so what's your perspective? What happened, Howard?
I don't know. I mean, the Democrats obviously took this great stand and got nothing out of it. So I guess you would have to count them as losers in this thing. The congressional Republicans, okay, they win some sort of Pyrrhic victory, I suppose. But, we're basically still at square one. They still have to do the job of putting us together.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
Exactly. I agree. I mean, all we're talking about is a delay. Now it's now February 8th when we're funding the government. All this talk about funding the government and what we just did was we funded it until February 8th, which is ridiculous. But as Howard said, the Democrats in their argument for shutting down the government was to protect the Dreamers, you know, through the DACA program, the Dreamers who have been here as kids, he brought here illegally as children, and Donald Trump said he would end that program. But when all is said and done, there's no guarantee that the Dreamers won't be deported. I mean, the only thing we got from Mitch McConnell was that he'll agree to a debate perhaps in February about the program. And somehow Chuck Schumer and the Democrats think that's a victory. But one, there's no guarantee what's going to happen with it. And two, we're forgetting about what the House will do about it. And the House, for all of Mitch McConnell's talking about, I'll agree to a vote, the House is pretty much against any kind of so-called amnesty for these Dreamers. And so, you know, there's no guarantee the Dreamers will get anything out of it. And a matter of fact, it's very likely, or perhaps likely, that the House would vote it down. So again, where does that leave us, and where does that leave the Dreamers?
Where that leads the Dreamers is that in all likelihood, they're going to start being deported in March.
Well, Cory Gardner, the Republican senator from Colorado, said today, he said, look, there's not going to be any mass deportations. Forget about that. But the fact is, there's a tremendous uncertainty of it. And when you have an attorney general like Jeff Sessions, and when you have a senior policy advisor like Stephen Miller, and also a chief of staff like John Kelly, all of them are hawks on immigration. They still see them as illegal immigrants. They still think that any kind of path to citizenship, which President Trump talked about yesterday as supporting, and you know, but now that they see it as amnesty, and there are tremendous roadblocks against any good deal for these Dreamers.
Trump seemed to stay out of this last showdown over the shutdown. He seemed a little quieter than usual about things. Was he being advised by maybe Mitch McConnell to just keep out of this whole thing?
I think yes, because every now and then he'll say a pronouncement that goes counter to what the Republicans stand for. And that's exactly what Trump said yesterday. He said, well, you know something, if they're here for 10 to 12 years, there could be a pathway to citizenship, and that would be great. And the White House said, what? And the Republicans said, what? Yeah. So they couldn't believe what they were hearing. But I think every time, first of all, given that obscenity that the president said in that meeting with Durbin and others, that didn't help the cause at all. And I think McConnell said, look, we can deal with this. We can deal with this. And the president, first of all, the president never likes to be out of the limelight, but he was quiet during those days. He met with Chuck Schumer on Friday, but that was the end of it. Schumer thought he had a deal, and Trump probably said, yes, we have a deal. And then he turned around and spoke to, you know, Stephen Miller and John Kelly and maybe Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, and suddenly Trump said, no, we don't have a deal. So
it seems like
I think Mitch McConnell...
It seems like it's whoever he talked to last.
Exactly. And I think that's why McConnell wanted the president to be quiet during the final days of negotiations.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it seems to be whoever he spoke to last, that's what his position is. And you end up getting these mixed messages coming out of the Republicans in the White House and the Republicans in Congress.
That's why the Republicans just went nuts yesterday when the president said his thing on his way, you know, on his way to Switzerland.
Ken, how about if you give the trivia question? We've got some people starting to try at this. Let's see if we can get some more people on the line.
Super Bowl is between the New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles. two teams from the East Coast. Did I tell you about my newspaper that was upside down? Anyway, so when was the last presidential election that featured the two major party nominees were also born on the East Coast?
Okay, and if you think you know the answer to that, call us at 513-419-7100. Who knows, if you get the answer right, you could win a political junkie button.
Yeah.
So, Ken, we've got a 3-week extension here, I think, if I remember the time frame correctly.
Just under 3 weeks, right? February 8th.
So what's to say that 3-week extension comes and goes and they haven't solved any of the problems that caused this original shutdown? I mean...
Well, remember, this is the fourth. That's a good question, because this is the fourth time that the Congress has passed a short-term stopgap spending bill because they can't come to an agreement. So it's happened four times already. There's no guarantee that anything will happen on February 8th. But here's where the Republicans have their strengths. Mitch McConnell said if the Democrats decide to call for another shutdown or they filibuster the talks on the budget, then he's going to withdraw the offer to have a vote on the DACA program. And so that puts the Democrats in a very weird position.
Yeah, I think that would be enough to keep them, make the Democrats back off.
Again, join us on that trivia question, 513-419-7100. Ken, what do you think this all portends for the midterms?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and it's probably impossible to answer. And the reason I say that is because if you remember the last shutdown in 2013, orchestrated by Ted Cruz and the Republicans, the polls showed that overwhelmingly, the American people blame the Republicans, and the Republicans will pay for it politically. But in 2014, by the time the elections rolled around, the Republicans gained seats in the House. They won control of the Senate. They picked up a lot of governors. They won overwhelming numbers of state legislatures around the country. So it's almost impossible to predict what's going to happen 10 months from now. But, and I look, for all we know, there's going to be so many other issues, so many more crises that happen between now and November. But look, the fact is that the Democrats themselves are already split on this, because if you look at the votes, you know, all those Democrats in tough re-election states, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, those kind of people, they all voted to end the shutdown as quick as possible, to end it, while the, you could say the purists in the Democratic Party, or including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, those people, many of whom are looking at the presidency or thought to be looking at the presidency in 2020, they all said, no, let's keep this going because we have no deal on DACA. We're not going to sell out these dreamers. So the Democratic Party showed it, too, is not united on this. And that's another feather in Mitch McConnell's cap.
Yeah, and this is a mid-year election or midterm election where, you know, the Republicans hold the White House. They hold both houses of Congress. The Democrats have a chance to make gains, but, you know what the polls said about this shutdown. The polls said that they were blaming Trump and the Republicans, you know, the majority of the people.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. So, Ken, what is your feeling, though? Do you think that that we'll be shut down again in 3 weeks, or do you think they'll be able to come to something?
No, I don't think there'll be a shutdown. But what I do fear and probably do predict, although predictions are kind of silly, but I do think that there's going to be another punting down the road, another 1 month, you know, delay, and we'll fund it. But I kind of think that the Democrats' hands are limited. I think the fact is that if they decide to disrupt the possibility, talk about a shutdown, McConnell has that weapon about the Dreamers. But if when all is said and done, and we do have this debate, and we do have the vote on the floor of the Senate about Dreamers, and let's see, even if it passes the Senate and it fails again, it fails in the House, then what did the Democrats get out of it? What did these people here, you know, the Dreamers here, get out of it? And I just kind of think that, especially with the primaries coming up in March, with the election 10 months away, I don't think there's an appetite. Look, there's never seemed to be an appetite for immigration overhaul. The Senate has passed it several times in the past few years, only for it to die in the House. For, you know, all these optimistic looks at February 8th, I just don't see anything changing or anything happening.
So, Ken, give us the trivia question again. We have some people who want to give it a try here. So give us the question, and we'll get to some of these calls here.
Okay, you have a Super Bowl between two teams from the East Coast. When was the last presidential election where the two candidates were born on the East Coast?
Okay, let's see if Mike knows the answer to this. Hi, Mike.
Hi. 1944, Roosevelt and Dewey.
Well, that's a great guess, but you'll be shocked to know that Thomas Dewey was born in Michigan. Even though he was the governor of New York at the time, Thomas Dewey was born in Owosso, Michigan. How do you like that?
Let's see if Joe has the answer for us.
Hey, I was thinking it was Michael Dukakis and George H.W. Bush in 1988.
That is a great guess because George H.W. Bush was born in Milton, Massachusetts. Everybody thinks he was born in Texas. He was born in Massachusetts. And, of course, Dukakis was born in Massachusetts as well, Brookline, Massachusetts. But that was not the most recent occasion.
Okay, Jen wants to try this. Jen?
I had the same guess. I'm out.
Well, thanks for being honest. We appreciate it. Let's talk to Larry. Hi, Larry. Who do you think it was? Larry, are you still with us? Okay. I think we've lost contact with Larry.
You know what? I never really liked Larry.
Oh,
I don't know.
Don't start on that.
It's just a feeling. It's just a feeling.
Don't start on. Let me try him out. Larry, are you there? Okay. No, we've lost Larry. Let's go to Michael. Hi, Michael.
How about Gore and Bush?
That sounds ridiculous. That sounds ridiculous to me because Bush is from Texas and Gore is from Tennessee. And Michael is correct.
Okay.
Because,
very good.
Because George W. Bush, that Texan who removes all that brush in Texas, was born in New Haven, Connecticut, and Al Gore was the son of a senator by the name of Albert Gore Sr., and he was born in Washington, D.C. So Michael is correct.
Hey, that's interesting because I would have thought the same thing. I thought Al Gore was from Tennessee. I thought that that George Bush was from Texas. I thought the same thing, and I would have said Dukakis and Father Bush.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah, that's what Howard was thinking.
But
also,
I knew about Bush being from Connecticut, but I didn't know about Gore being born in Washington, which makes perfect sense because his father was there, and that's where his family lived.
And Michael, stay on the line. Hang on just a second, Ken. Michael, stay on the line so that we can get the information on where to send your prize to. So thank you very much. Howard, you got the wrong one. I can't believe that. That's so unlike you.
It was close. It was a Bush. Look.
Howard predicted Frank Lausche, which I don't know why he did it. That makes no sense to me. I don't know why he would do that.
Ken,
DeSalle.
Are there a greater percentage of presidents?
DeSalle. Well, he was born in New York.
Are there a greater percentage?
Mike DeSalle was?
Yes.
I didn't know that. I did not know that.
Yes, sir.
Behave, Ken.
I'm sorry.
Are there a greater percentage of presidents from the East Coast? Does it seem like, or are they more spread out?
No, I mean, obviously, Ohio. You think of Ohio as the birthplace of the presidents. I think were there seven or eight from eight. Born in Ohio, and a lot of the early ones, of course, were born in Virginia. But you know, for example, of course, Donald Trump was born in New York, and somebody would say, well, maybe it was Trump and Hillary, but Hillary, of course, was born in Illinois, and I can think in Evanston or around under Chicago. I think she was born in Chicago.
Yeah.
So. I don't think the East Coast really is. I mean, you think of people who tried to be president. I think Nelson Rockefeller tried to be president, you know, so many times. And of course, FDR was born in New York. But I still think Ohio holds the record.
Ken, now that the shutdown is over, President Trump heads off to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. And given his protectionist leanings, how much of a surprise is this that he'd end up attending an annual gathering that has all these people there in a global free trade?
Well, it does allow him to meet heads of state, which he enjoys. And of course, he looks forward to those kind of meetings all the time. But you're absolutely right. His views on trade and protectionist policies are definitely so different than most of the countries, most of our allies around the world. And it just seems like the U.S. influence, which once was so gigantic in these kind of things, has really lessened in the past year. And you see countries like Japan and China forming trade deals with countries around the world. So it almost just feels like the U.S.'s influence around the world has been eclipsed. And, polls will just, it's just not me saying this. I mean, polls are indicating that it's because of what Trump has to say about pulling out of the TPP and pulling out of the climate accords, the Paris climate accords, and belittling our allies like South Korea on trade deals and unfavorable terms. So, you know, he's there and he'll meet with Netanyahu and he'll meet with Theresa May, I think. But for the most part, it seems like the U.S. role in the world, at least in the issues of trade, has really been lessened in the past year.
But it sounds like he wants to go over there and, you know, make a point that, you know, we've pulled out of all these trade deals. But in his mind, the U.S. economy is booming. We are doing great. We are doing wonderful. And it's because of me. And I think that's the message he's delivering over there.
Well, one thing you cannot deny is that the stock market is is zooming to, sure. I mean, not with not with no stop. So so somebody, certainly investors in this country, must think something is going right. But, I mean, if you look at those numbers, it's just breaking the record. Now, the fact is, it's kind of interesting to see the president take credit for it. And, you know, that's what the president does. But there's no questioning that the Dow is just, you know, just to the moon, basically.
And GDP, the gross domestic product, also has been projected higher as well. So,
Ken, that jump in the stock market, how much of that do you think is tied to the tax reform?
Well, certainly, I mean, business likes it, of course. And, yeah. I mean, if you look at what happened from the tax bill, aside from the wealthy individuals, which is what the Democrats have always been complaining about, but it's true,
right.
The wealthy did benefit. Maybe the middle class will get some kind of a benefit down the line. We'll see. But certainly businesses, corporations loved it, and they were expressing, maybe they were expressing their love by looking at the stock market. Absolutely. Can I just say one thing, though? I just got an email from a friend of mine named Patty who said, you know, how could you not like Larry? And I've been thinking about that. I really feel bad what I said earlier about Larry.
So you want to apologize to Larry?
I do. I do like him. I like him very, very much. And I want him, I mean, if he wants to have dinner at Howard's house tonight, that's okay with me.
No.
Because I want to apologize.
To,
what?
Stop.
Okay. Sorry.
Larry.
I was just trying to make things right.
That's right. I was... 513-419-7100 if you would like to join our conversation with Ken Rudin and Howard Wilkinson. Let's talk to Steve. Hi, Steve. Hello, Steve.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go right ahead.
I'm wondering about the opioid crisis, and to me, I see that as a bipartisan issue. So both Democrats and Republicans should have input into that, but I'm wondering why there's not been a congressional investigation into the role that Big Pharma played in the opioid crisis. And I want to know, were they aware of the addictive quality of opioids when those were initially sold? And how did they get doctors to continue to renew those prescriptions, knowing they were so addictive?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there are a number of municipalities all over Ohio and the state of Ohio and other governments around the country who have sued the manufacturers and have sued the distributors over those very issues. And so it's, you know, it's in court and they've got some explaining to do.
Has President Trump ever declared this to be a national emergency, or has he done anything like that?
Not that I'm aware.
Well, he gave a major speech maybe about a month ago talking about the scourge of how awful it is. But as far as funding, there was no discussion at all.
Right.
Right. But exactly. He gave this big speech and it was everything he said was correct, but there was no accompanying funding. And that's one of the things that Democrats regret about this shutdown, because you know, as Steve points out correctly, that this is a nonpartisan issue. It's affecting everybody all over the country, rich and poor, white and black, D's and R's. I mean, it's everybody. And the thought that there's still not money coming through, you wonder about the role of Big Pharma. Certainly, you know that Big Pharma is also the big opposition to legalize marijuana around the country, because they certainly don't want to accept that for medicinal purposes, because they feel that that's, you know, you need pills for that. But you're absolutely right. There's something going on, and I mean, I don't know what it is and how to investigate it, because nobody seems to be willing to.
No, he was talking about why wouldn't Congress, with this being such a bipartisan issue, why wouldn't they investigate it?
Well, you know, I mean, this is speculation, and I probably shouldn't even say something like this, but, you know, it's the same reason why you don't have investigation into the NRA and the easy access to guns, because of its lobbying influence. And so maybe I'm not equating Big Pharma to the NRA, but maybe many members of Congress just owe a lot of their elections to Big Pharma. But, I mean, again, I'd have to do more research into that.
But the questions that the caller is raising are best, probably best going to be answered by the courts in these lawsuits that the cities and states have brought.
Okay. 513-419-7100 to join us, or you can email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Elaine sent us a tweet, and her question is, if the GOP does not now negotiate on DACA, won't that show how underhanded they're being?
Well, we don't know. Look, McConnell says there will be negotiations. What Trump said, you should read what Trump said yesterday. It's pretty startling. So if the president is going to be taken at his word, then there is possibility of movement on DACA. But again, if this was just Trump being Trump, and there was, and maybe he changes his mind, as Howard said, maybe, you know, the last person he hears from will make him change his mind. But we'll see. I mean, we'll certainly see by February 8th, when we're up at our next crisis, and we'll see if there is a, you know, if there's any give and take. It's clear that there's a large number of bipartisan senators led by Joe Manchin, the Democrat of West Virginia, and Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine, to form some kind of a compromise, some kind of a solution on the immigration situation, because I think everybody agrees, including President Trump, that it's a situation, it's a system that is completely broken and needs fixing very badly.
Yeah, and on that note of give and take, Ken, Senator Chuck Schumer took back his wall funding offer because no DACA. So if they get a deal on DACA, will Schumer then have to go back and agree to fund the wall? Will that happen?
I thought that was a mistake of Schumer to say that, because when he says I'm completely rescinding this offer of fully funding the wall the way President Trump wants, which is something like $25+ billion, then of course the Republicans say, well, if that's off the table, then DACA could be off the table. It's just such a childish back and forth, and nobody seems to be winning. But what it does show is how limited the power is of the minority. First of all, they have no power in the House at all. It's limited in the Senate, and again, there's not much they can do when you want to say something like that, and the Republicans can say, okay, well, we'll take back the DACA promise. So,
Schumer can't even negotiate. He's not even in a position to be able to negotiate.
Howard, when you have one party that rules both houses of Congress and then the presidency, and how is it that they still can't prevent a shutdown?
Well, because as Ken was pointing out, I mean, you know, you can get things through the Senate that you can't get through the House. You know, they're made up of a whole different wing of a Republican Party. And it's very difficult to get the pieces of the Republican Party to come together on anything, much less bring the Democrats in.
And plus the fact that, for the most part, so much of the filibuster opportunities are gone. You could no longer filibuster cabinet appointees, judges, things like that. Right. Supreme Court judges, there's no filibuster. But they still need 60 votes to pass the budget. Until that changes, the Democrats will still have some say in getting a budget passed.
Yeah, that's true.
Howard, did you catch my cold from this from this microphone?
Yes.
I'm going to back off this microphone a little bit.
Thank you, Ken. You're so nice. Yeah. Ken, we got a call from Bill, and he's saying that we seem to be showing bias by not giving Trump credit for the economy. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that and how you would address that.
Well, look, obviously something is working. Clearly something is working. And you can see by the stock market, you can see that that unemployment is down, which was, in fairness, it was continuing to go down under Obama, but it has not changed. So I never know. It's hard to say how much credit you give to the president, because if you think of, for example, I think of George Bush, the first is George Bush. The economy was really, really bad. They raised taxes in this deal that Newt Gingrich hated in 1990. And there was terrible recessions all over the country. Towards the end of the Bush administration, the economy got really, really better. More employment, better numbers and things like that. But was it his policies? I don't know. So look, I'm not I mean, look,
and he didn't get credit for it in the election either.
Well, no, he didn't, because I think once all those months of continuing unemployment and, right. and recession. I mean, I was in New Hampshire in 1992. So many businesses that were up there a few years before, I mean, everything was shuttered, everything closed down, and it was the Bush recession. So I think if a president gets blamed for a bad economy, I think the president should also be credited, like Donald Trump, with a good economy. How much it really is what he does, that's up to debate. But there's no question. Look, the fact is, Trump is president, and the economy is doing well.
Yes.
So let's move on to what's going on with the special counsel Robert Mueller and his investigation of Russian meddling. Where do things stand at this point in that investigation, Ken? Are you seeing a shift?
Well, the fact is, it seems like Mueller seems to be getting close to trying to make a case of potential obstruction of justice. We're talking about Trump, what he knew regarding the Russians and the Russian involvement in the 2016 election. They've already talked to Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. He's the first cabinet member to speak to the investigators on Mueller's team. Michael Flynn, the former national security director, agency head, has talked to them. We don't know what Mueller knows or what he's getting, but the fact is that the White House is nervous about it. If you notice that there's almost every speech Trump makes, whether it has anything to do with it or not, he talks about there's no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. He has given mixed messages himself about speaking to the special counsel in an interview. But yesterday, he seemed to be open to it. A few months ago, he said, definitely. Then the White House said, no, I don't think so. And then yesterday, he said, yes, I would be open to it. But then the White House backtracked and said, well, there are certain conditions that have to be met. So we don't know how close a Mueller-Trump meeting is, but we do know that Mueller is proceeding. You know, you talk about a shutdown. There was definitely no shutdown of Robert Mueller. The investigation is going full speed. And while members of Congress, Republicans, are criticizing the FBI, they're criticizing Mueller, they're criticizing Comey, they're talking about these emails between these two FBI agents that somehow is about a big conspiracy. The fact is that nothing is deterring Mueller, and the president is clearly nervous.
Yeah, and what he had said yesterday about, he's willing and ready to speak to Mueller, the president's lawyers had to be slapping themselves in the heads, saying, what is he saying? I mean, this is not the kind of thing that you walk into lightly.
Why Ty Cobb, why Ty Cobb, the president's attorney, said, wait a second, there are conditions that need to be made first.
Exactly. And that's the lawyer's job in a case like this.
So one of the terms I keep hearing, Ken, is perjury trap, that there's concern that the Mueller's doing this to try to get Trump to perjure himself.
Well, the president has a way of thinking that he's the smartest guy in the room, and he has a way of just, wooing over the people he's listening to. But because he often speaks off the top of his head, sometimes he contradicts himself of what he said an hour before or a day before. There is a risk that many White House attorneys feel that he will say something that will perjure himself. And I'm surprised that I'm surprised they would even let the president do this, have this kind of thing. But the alternative might be a subpoena, and that could not be ruled out either.
Is it for sure that he would have to be under oath during questioning by Mueller, Howard?
No. I mean, Mueller could do it any way he wants, but I think he would want questioning under oath.
Ken?
Don't you?
Yeah, and the president could say that, maybe the president, that's one of the conditions. He may not say.
Right.
He may say it's not under oath. I believe when Hillary Clinton met with the FBI, she was not under oath.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was something that the Trump people objected to very heavily, the fact that how could you not be under oath? So it depends on what conditions that could be worked out. But of course, Mueller, as Howard says, would want them to be under oath.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Ken, you're saying the investigation right now, it's shifted more toward looking into obstruction of justice. How are you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure.
What do you think that means for the original focus of the investigation, the Russian collusion? Are they straying away from that, or is that in the background waiting to pop up again once they settle the matter of has there been any obstruction?
Well, I don't think it's one or the other. It's not either or. It's the old, you know, the old joke about Gerald Ford about chewing gum and walking at the same time. Mueller can do both, and sometimes, as we learned with Paul Manafort, I mean, what Manafort is accused of doing predates his time in the White House and may have nothing to do with Russian collusion. But the fact is, if there is obstruction of justice, it's to obstruct people finding out what kind of collusion there may have been. So it really is not two separate investigations.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. I mean, there's not that big a difference between, you know, the two, and one leads to the other.
So what do you think in terms of the interview with Attorney General Jeff Sessions? What do you think they talked about, Howard? Do we have any ideas?
I would assume that they were talking about why he had conversations with the Russian ambassador during the campaign. I mean, I think that topic would certainly come up if you had Jeff Sessions sitting down.
And hasn't Sessions said in the past that he was a senator at the time and that's why he had contact with?
Yeah, he was, but he was also a key person in the Trump campaign.
That's right. He was the first senator, in fact, to endorse Donald Trump. And he also met with him after the election, the Russians after the election, that he later remembered. So, look, there's a reason why Sessions pulled away from, you know, disqualified himself from being part of the investigation because of his connections, because of his meetings with the Russians. And I'm sure that's what Mueller talked about. Mm-hmm. And you know something? Sessions is in a very weird position because he has spent a good part of 2017 being ridiculed by the president, you know, saying how ineffective our so-called attorney general, our weak attorney general. And so you don't know if maybe part of him would like to say, well, you know, I'll show you who's weak. But at the same time, everything in public, Jeff Sessions has said, has always been in praise of the president. It's like Lindsey Graham, too. I mean, Lindsey Graham was ridiculed and mocked by Trump during the campaign, and somehow he's become a Trump sycophant during much of the year. And you just wonder why they do that. But I guess, you know, you could be like Jeff Flake and be an opponent and then realize that your political standing back home is zero. And that's what Jeff Flake learned. And maybe others don't want to learn it that way.
Mm-hmm. And go back to this for just a few minutes, as long as we're talking about this investigation. You've got the missing FBI texts from the two anti-Trump, pro-Hillary FBI officials. And you've got Senator Ron Johnson, who's chair of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, saying an informant has confirmed the existence of a secret society inside the FBI that's working against President Trump. I mean, do you see any evidence of political motivation by the FBI, or do you just view this as an aberration?
No, if anything, the politics is coming. I mean, in my view, the politics is coming from Congress because they seem to be much more interested in investigating, for example, Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS because of that dossier, what they found out. And they seem to be more interested in investigating these two FBI agents, where when they talked about a secret society, look, these two were having an affair. And so, you know, I mean, that's,
I suppose that's, we know, a secret that's what society.
Exactly. I mean, and to focus on that as a conspiracy within the FBI to bring down Donald Trump when there's a much bigger issue, the elephant in the room is definitely what Russia did and what Russia knew. And the fact that, you know, the stealing of the emails from the DNC and John Podesta and things like that. I mean, and also the use of Russian influence in Facebook with all its anti-Hillary stuff. I mean, the fact that so many Republicans in Congress are focusing on the people who are trying to do the investigations just says so much more about politics than one would like to hear.
It may just be a whole, a way to distract attention away from what the real issues are here.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join us, and John joins us now. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yes, I'd just like to
point out that, in my opinion, prior to the election of President Trump, the economy seemed like it was moving in the right direction. And every time people pointed that out, our president said that those numbers were fake. But now he points to those numbers as if they came directly from the Bible. You guys have a great show. I've been listening to it for years. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, John.
Thank you.
Ken, any thoughts on that?
For years. Didn't we? We started at 1 o'clock. It feels like years. No, John is exactly right. I mean, everything is fake news and fake polls when it doesn't go the president's way. And if it does go his way, I mean, the fact is that he'll say these terrible things about the New York Times and yet sit down with the New York Times with it for interviews because he wants good coverage. So, you know, everything is fake if it doesn't go his way. Like the polls, he'll always talk about these fake polls that showed Hillary Clinton winning. But if it just shows him doing well, then he'll cite these polls. And that's what he does. He just needs that affirmation and he'll do it whatever he goes. But John is exactly right. The economy, as I said earlier, was doing well in the latter years of Obama. Now, for the long time, unemployment was pretty high. It was 11-12%. And there was concern that Obama might not even survive his reelection in 2012. The fact that Mitt Romney couldn't capitalize on a bad economy was, you know, a lot of people say, well, that may have been Romney's fault. But in the latter part of the Obama administration, John is correct. The economy was getting much better and continuing to get better into the Trump administration.
Ken, also the story come out about Oprah Winfrey possibly running for president in 2020. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that whole thing, possibility of Trump versus Oprah.
Well, I mean, I know, look, I mean, my personal feeling is that we should be smarter. I'm not blaming you, Mark, because everybody was talking about that. And I already have, I think, 15 or 20 different Oprah for President buttons already for 2020. So, you know, if the buttons exist, you know, it's real. Yeah. But this is just so silly. I mean, it was a good speech. There were a lot of good speeches at the Golden Globes, right. But Oprah...
Hasn't Oprah at least one of her...
It was a good speech, but it wasn't an inaugural address. I mean, it was, you know, it was at the Golden Globes for...
Well, and hasn't Oprah at least gotten the word out that, no, this isn't happening?
Yeah.
No, actually, that's not what I heard it too. Or Gayle King, or maybe Oprah's partner said that she's not dismissed it, or she's thinking seriously, or whatever. She's not rejecting it out of hand. But look, I can't imagine the thought of an entertainer being in the White House. I can't even imagine that. Oh, wait a second.
Wait a minute. You're right, Ken. So, okay, looking ahead, next week, Tuesday, President Trump's giving his first State of the Union address. So, wondering from both of you, Ken and Howard, what are your thoughts? What are your expectations about what we might hear and what might happen around that speech?
I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, of course, it'll be a written speech and it'll be written by people who are serious people. But again, it goes back to what I think of during his inaugural address. It was a very bleak speech and you know, how bad things were going. And I suspect that a State of the Union might be where things stand. And he'll say that after a year of him with the economy moving up, with the Dow Jones breaking records, that the economy is good. I mean, unless, you know, he starts talking about Stormy Daniels, I think it's going to be a very well-received speech.
How many Democrats at this point are saying they're not going to attend the speech?
I don't know.
Well, you know, I know that John Lewis is among those who's doing that, right. But John Lewis also boycotted the George W. Bush inauguration. So I think that doesn't matter at all. I think it's all show. If Republicans ever said, you know, I'm going to boycott it, then that's a story. But for, you know, for liberal Democrats to say, I'm going to boycott it, to me, I don't think it's worth a headline.
Yeah. Yeah. What were your expectations, Howard?
I think pretty much the same as Ken. I mean, he's going to go up and he's going to brag about how good the economy is under him, under his leadership. And again, he's going to totally ignore what happened prior to him coming into office a year ago, but he's going to go in there and make this case and say, don't argue with me because I have produced. I have produced results.
Ken and Howard, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us today.
Before we go, Oprah has ruled out running for president. She just gave a speech a short time ago. She rules it out.
All right.
So the only entertainer left is Howard Wilkinson.
Okay.
Howard 2020. Well, thanks to both of you again. Political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.